From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chinese smartphone maker Xiaomi is the second most valuable startup in the world right now after Uber. Its name means little rice, and the company has been called the Apple of China. Xiaomi's goal to sell its low-cost, Chinese-designed products and services all over the world. Just 5 years after its launch, it has 500 million smartphone users. Its phones are sleek, cheap, and sophisticated. They may challenge Apple. They may challenge China. This hour on Point, technology guru Clay Shirky looks at China, American high tech, and the world through the story of Xiaomi. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you ready to see Chinese companies challenge American companies on design? Are we already there? Is there an innate conflict between a growing Chinese information tech sector and China's authoritarian government? Can they have both? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the controversial act passed yesterday by the Senate allowing the U.S. government and private sector to share information about cybersecurity threats. But first, joining me now from Shanghai is Clay Shirky, writer, consultant, teacher on the effects of the Internet on society. He's professor of journalism at New York University, Shanghai, author of Here Comes Everybody and Cognitive Surplus. His new book is Little Rice, Smartphones, Xiaomi, and the Chinese Dream. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Clay Shirky in Shanghai, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
There's a lot you could pay attention to and think about in the internet world, in the tech world. What drew you to this once little, now huge company?
You know, the thing that started me getting interested in Xiaomi was really an accident. I got lost on the subway in Shanghai. I got out at the wrong stop. I was wandering through a mall. I needed a cell phone. I slowed down to sort of get my bearings, and I saw this booth selling phones. I bought a nice-looking phone. Thought, okay, this will be as good as anything. It said Mi 3 on the back. Seemed fine. Got back on the subway. I went off to NYU's campus at the time. And when I got to the campus, anytime I pulled that phone out to do anything with it, one of the Chinese students would say, where did you get that phone? Not what kind is it? They all recognized it. But where did you get it? And I would ask, you know, why? What's special about this phone? And they said, that phone is supposed to be sold out in all of China. I had lucked out into their first big hit, which is the Mi 3. So I started paying attention to this company because of what you said in the intro, which is that this was a beautifully designed phone. And it wasn't just a copycat phone. It wasn't a knockoff of a Samsung or whatever. And I thought, well, who are these people? So I just started following them. And the more I looked, the more they struck me as people who weren't just another phone manufacturer trying to get into that market, but people who were really thinking design and manufacturing in a kind of 21st century model.
Explain what makes this special, Clay, because Americans, like many of the people, are used to all kinds of cell phones and smartphones being around. The idea of a Chinese company making a smartphone, I mean, okay, you know, that sounds like maybe a dime a dozen, and yet you've devoted a whole book to this and made it this sort of fulcrum for the future of the known world. What's going on?
So there are two things that make Xiaomi special. One is the product. The other is actually the design of the company. And I talk about them both in the book because they are so related to one another. So the product is interesting because Xiaomi looked at the phone market, especially in China, their first market, and said, the logic of this market looks like there's a luxury product. You buy an iPhone if you can afford it, maybe a Samsung, or you go for the cheapest phone available. There's nothing in the middle, really, where anybody could carve out a niche. And what the Xiaomi people said is, if we buy and make cheaper hardware, but we make the operating system really good because the interface becomes increasingly important as these phones become increasingly powerful. If we make the interface and the design of the hardware good enough, people will buy a mid-priced phone that is surprisingly much better than you'd expect for the cost, or they will see that cost performance trade-off as something that they want to, you know, they want to take advantage of. They'll spend more than for a cheap phone, but less than they would for an iPhone. And that middle market niche that they cut out for themselves was such a surprise that even the people following cell phones in China misunderstood what was going on. There's an analyst who I looked up when I was researching the book who said when Xiaomi launched their first phone, oh, this is only going to work in the big cities. This will never go nationwide. And then, of course, going nationwide is exactly what Xiaomi did.
And in an enormous way. I mean, they have a valuation right up there with Uber. They've got a bunch of products
right
now.
Absolutely.
Among them, the Mi Note, kind of a phablet, phone, tablet. Here's Android Authority, Clay. They do reviews and news about Android devices, reviewing Xiaomi's Mi Note phone.
All in all, the Xiaomi Mi Note is one very solid device from hardware to software, and is one of the most enjoyable devices that I have had the pleasure of using from a Chinese OEM in quite some time, and that's why it's getting our Editor's Choice 2015 award. It's just a shame that this isn't coming to the States, but maybe this is Xiaomi's way of teasing us, and if it is, it's certainly one hell of a teaser.
Editor's Choice 2015, first of all, explain what's special about the design coming out of China here as opposed to anything else, and how much it really is from China, and why aren't they in the States?
So those are three really good questions, and they all relate to one another. Mm-hmm. So first of all, what's special about the design is that Xiaomi understood the whole idea of user experience. Basically, the more complicated our hardware becomes, the more the interface is itself the thing that people like about the product.
Yep.
So when Xiaomi started in 2010, they're a manufacturing company, but the first thing they launched was actually the operating system. And they gave it away for free, and they had people download and test it on other phones. So for a year and a half, they didn't even make a phone. They just found people who were willing to change the operating system on their Samsung phones, mostly. Samsung was who they were going after. And they just concentrated on making the performance snappier and the battery life better, which are the user's two biggest complaints. And that obsessive focus on not just how does it look, how does it feel in your hand, but is it responsive when you try to turn the page or launch an app, and does the battery last all day? It was only when they'd gotten that basically right that they then started making hardware.
A kind of keep it so simple, stupid approach.
And
what really matters.
Start with the experience that really matters for the user, which is it's a black slab of glass. Everything is a black slab of glass if you're buying a phone these days. So what's on the black slab becomes the user experience. And they got that right first and then optimized the hardware around that.
I'm looking at Jeff Fowler in the Wall Street Journal. Xiaomi Mi Note is the best smartphone you can't buy in America. Why not?
Yep. So second point is Xiaomi starts in the Chinese market, which has the well-understood advantages of manufacturing electronics, best in the world by now a long chalk, but also has a set of policies, weak protection of patents and so forth, that mean when you grow up in the Chinese market, moving to other countries creates these speed bumps. So they move to India, and within days, they are sued by Ericsson for patent infringement, and they have to go negotiate all of this.
So is it really Chinese designed, or is it ripped off, Clay?
Well, so the Ericsson patents are much more about software. The interesting thing about Xiaomi, and this is a complicated thing, the Mi 4, the phone after the first phone I bought, that is very close to a copy of the iPhone, like at a distance of about a yard they'd like it to look like an iPhone, whereas both the Mi 3 and the Note are really genuinely well designed without having this kind of homage to Apple thing going on. So they're capable of doing both, and they just go back and forth, which is a little confusing for Americans. But the if they were to open in the U.S., it's in part the patent protection issues, of course, but it's also the U.S. market isn't the market they're optimized for. For them, the big markets are not the United States and France and Germany. Mm-hmm. The big markets are Nigeria and Mexico and Indonesia. They are these markets where there is suddenly a very large group of consumers who will pay a little more money to get a lot more phone. And it is that middle market, which is a vast superset of the rich world market, about 4 billion people compared mm-hmm. to about 1 billion people, mm-hmm. Xiaomi has become the third largest Android manufacturer in the world in the space of, as you said in the intro, in the space of 5 years, without selling a single handset in the United States or Northern Europe.
That was a really interesting heads up to me right there. I mean, there's a lot more to look at in the story of this company, but right there, this kind of huge global mid-market that America and manufacturers and designers may not even have on their screen. They don't think about Nigeria and Mexico and India. Here's the co-founder, CEO of Xiaomi, Lei Jun. This was in April in New Delhi. Super sales in very, very short time. And you'll hear him, you know, calling out to this big crowd there in India saying, how are you? I'm very happy to be in China. He says, by mistake, to be in India. He's going after market, well, at a sort of a quarter of the price of an Apple iPhone with a very sophisticated product out of China. Here's Lei Jun.
Hello. How are you? Indian B fans, I'm very happy to be in China, to be in India.
And they sold how many, how fast, Clay, in that market?
They sold everything they have tried to sell in India. They sell in lots of tens or in some cases, hundreds of thousands. And they do these flash
sales. Seconds, yeah.
Where in seconds these things will be sold out. And this is one of the things, when I was talking about the importance of Xiaomi is not just the product design, but the company design. If I had to say what was most important about Xiaomi, it's not that they have well-designed handsets. There are a lot of companies that can do that. Huawei can do that. HTC can do that. Yep. This is not a big secret. What Xiaomi has done that's really unusual, they were founded in 2010. They looked at online commerce and they looked at social media and they didn't say, these are interesting add-ons. They said, this is the baseline. We're starting from here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with big tech thinker Clay Shirky about what he's learned from a year in China about freedom and control and the Chinese tech industry, watching the young, surging Chinese company Xiaomi. They make smartphones and sell them all over the world, except in the USA. His new book is Little Rice, Smartphones, Xiaomi, and the Chinese Dream, excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Yes, there's just a simple business story here, though business stories are not really simple. Also, some much bigger stories about how Chinese society and government's going to work, about how the United States is or is not competing for the whole world's markets these days, and whether China steps ahead with companies like Xiaomi. You can join us this hour. Do you know this company, their phones, the story behind Xiaomi? Can China have it all? Tight Communist Party rule and information age tech leadership. Can China challenge American high tech in the global mid-market, most of the world, and win? I've got a little more tape here of co-founder, CEO Lei Jun. This is at a TechCrunch Beijing conference in a couple of years back now. This is 2011, but just talking about a basic. He's talking about why China was such a desirable market for his company to grow up in, here translated by TechCrunch.
China is the largest single market. It's a 25% of the market share of the world. So if you can win in China, you will have a greater chance to win in the world. And China is an open market. It is not a market regulated or controlled by the carrier. In America, you can only buy phones from the carrier. But in China, you can buy mobile phone from any outlet.
Open market, okay, but not an open society, not politically. That's for darn sure. Clay Shirky joins us from Shanghai. Ryan's calling from Menominee, Wisconsin. Ryan, hi, you're on the air with Clay.
Hi there. Glad to be on. I just wanted to say this is a really inspirational story as far as business tech stories go. If you think there's such a negative stereotype on Chinese goods, and I know you touched on that a bit earlier, but there's such a negative stereotype, at least in this country, of Chinese goods.
You mean copycats or lower quality or not yep. creative, that kind of thing?
Exactly. So it's really good to see that this ingenuity has no geographic or socioeconomic boundaries, that a company can succeed where a lot of people would look and say, well, there's so much of this on the market, we're not going to be able to make this work. And it's really inspirational, and I think a lot of companies will probably get a lot of inspiration from this.
Inspiration, and to see that it's happening in China. Ryan, I appreciate your call. Clay, I mean, describe the stereotype that Ryan's talking about and what we're seeing in terms of evolution here. He's celebrating, he says, ingenuity that knows no geographic or social bounds. Is China stepping onto a new part of the stage here? In what way exactly?
Certainly they're stepping onto a new part of the stage. Xiaomi, although I've picked them as an illustrator of the pattern, is one of many companies. I mean, if you look at the Qingdao refrigerator company, which renamed themselves Haier, in part to have a name that said, we understand that when we make these appliances, we're making them in the model of quality that we're emulating essentially a German company. And Haier has become now a company that's doing something like Xiaomi, which is they're climbing up the quality curve with design, but they're still keeping costs controlled. So a lot of the innovation that's going on in China, it falls out of this American model of the innovation is in the product, right? There's enormous innovation in China in logistics, in supply chains, and all the boring stuff that actually gets something made and delivered to you. So one of the stories I tell in the book is that when in the United States, when e-commerce shows up, we already had mail and catalogs. We had 1-900 numbers. We had all these other working commercial systems. In China, when e-commerce showed up, it was on the heels of the building out of the electrical grid and the interstate highway system. It's all happening at once here. And so when you get something like a Taobao or a Tmall, which are the two largest e-commerce sites run by the same company, that's not an addition to commerce. For many people, that is what commerce is. So one of the sources of this innovation is really the ability for Xiaomi to step in and say, we're just going to take e-commerce for granted. If anybody wants to sell our phones in a store, they have to buy them from us at full freight. We won't take them back. We won't deal with the logistic risk. We're only selling our phones online. And they say, we're doing all of our marketing with our users. We're not buying ads on the sides of buses. We're not buying ads on TV. We're going to say, if we create a good experience, people will talk about it. And so it's not just innovation for the product, although they have done some of that. It is really this whole rethinking of how you do business if you could take a bunch of stuff for granted, like social networks, like online storefronts.
Is that a kind of leapfrog of American ways? Are Americans stodgy about how they do business? Are they not keeping up with this Chinese company or Chinese company generally on the sort of how to get it done front?
It certainly looks that way to me. I mean, I've been now out of the U.S. for a year and a half, and so I now see the U.S. from a distance. But the story for 30 years in the U.S. about China has been Americans used to make things for the American market, and now China makes things for the American market. And that's not the Xiaomi story. The Xiaomi story is China has figured out how to make things in a large but relatively poor country. China has certainly enormous wealth concentrated in some places, but by and large, the GDP per capita is the same as Tunisia and the Dominican Republic. That fits Xiaomi to compete on a global stage. If they can get to be the third largest Android phone seller and never sell a phone in North America, that says the American challenge is not us versus China for who sells locally. That says that if American businesses want to participate, figuring out how to reach this sort of 4 billion person middle market becomes the new challenge. And there I think Xiaomi can be an inspiration because they haven't done anything an American company couldn't emulate, but it really requires a sense that the global markets and not just the local markets are the ones that are going to set the next 30 years of sort of commercial norms.
You portray American companies sort of selling their products at the country club while the Chinese are out selling to the whole world, the world as it is. Here's a little bit of this is Wall Street Journal's George Fowler. He was talking with the president of the company, Bin Lin, at a global technology conference. This is just last week in Laguna Beach, California. Xiaomi's president in the U.S. for this, and asking him how he would respond to charges that Xiaomi is still just imitating Apple. And here's the Xiaomi president pointing out unique features of Xiaomi phones.
Our phone supports call recording. So if with the consent of the other guy, you can say, hey, you know, I would love to record this conversation, and one press, you can start doing recordings. On the camera, the Xiaomi phone has this age and gender detection. And when you do a selfie image, it does detect your age and gender, and based on that, it's going to do a beautifier. Yes, make your face look nicer on a selfie.
Clay, what is that? A beautifier? What is on the
phone? Yes, so this is pure East Asia. This is – so the selfie culture has reached its most gonzo instantiation in East Asia. It's where the selfie stick comes from.
Yep.
And there is – if you go to an electronics market here, there's basically competition for various generations of selfie sticks now, Bluetooth versus you have to plug the selfie stick in and so forth. But the basic engineering point Lin Bin is making is that these phones have a bunch of features that are suited to the market, like a selfie beautifier. When you take a picture of yourself, the phone will clean up your skin, and if it detects gender, it will redden your lips if it thinks you're a woman. So there are all of these kind of norms.
And did I read even make your eyes look a little bigger? Is that part of it too?
Yes.
Look like manga characters?
You don't get quite to the manga. You don't get quite to the manga extreme. But this sense of we know why you're taking a selfie, so we're just going to scooch it along a little bit. You know, Photoshop is the new makeup.
This
now happens in camera on the phone. It's not even like a feature you have to drag the photo out and edit. It's even less work than an Instagram filter.
You say this is sort of like the moment where Akio Morita took Sony for Japan and made it into a super high-quality producer instead of just a producer and Xiaomi going down that road.
And Morita said, I want Made in Japan to stand for quality. He used that to motivate his employees. There's a joke in some early Woody Allen film about cheap junk that's made in Japan. I didn't see it till much later. Mm. And when I heard them say something was made in Japan, I thought that meant it was good. And it took me a while to understand that when the movie was made in Japan meant it's junk and will fall apart.
Mark in Miami, you're on the phone with Clay in Shanghai. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how y'all doing, guys?
Okay.
Yeah, this is Mark. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I was saying in retrospect that the United States, we're supposed to be in a leading in innovation and technology, but China has been researching us for years technology-wise, as in they knew United States was relying on them because we can take our tech over to them, get it patent built and made for cheap. Mm-hmm. So China say, you know what? If that country think they're going to be on top and we make it for pennies on a dollar, we would flip the script on them. So United States, we should have been way ahead of our game. And this is a century 21 on technology. We supposed to be leading in innovation. So China's saying in retrospect, hey, we got it wrong. We got them confused. And now they finna switch up.
Yeah, Mark, we've got it. China flips the script on the U.S. How about that, Clay? I mean, a lot of people made a lot of money manufacturing in China. Mark's worried about it in Miami, but was there another way? And what about now? Is the U.S. not the innovation leader?
So the U.S. is plainly an innovation leader in some cases and in some cases not. I mean, the story's become complicated enough. Mm-hmm. But I think Mark is absolutely right about flipping the script because the other thing, you know, back to the list of features from that Laguna Beach conference, those features are important. It's nice to have a selfie phone that, you know, cleans up your image or whatever, call recording, fine. The big deal is that many of those features were suggested by the users. So Lei Jun, the CEO, has said about a third of the features in MIUI, which is Xiaomi's version of Android, have come as suggestions from users. So what China has done, and in particular what Xiaomi has done, is they've taken advantage of an enormous amount of user feedback to figure out how to innovate. And it is not too late. I think there is a certain, at this point, a certain sort of doom and gloom story about American innovation. But in fact, Xiaomi's ability to use an open network to solicit feedback from its own users and figure out how to make the product continually better, in the manner of Toyota, you know, back to the Japanese parallel, that is absolutely something companies in the U.S. could do.
And in fact,
what we know from
I
was just going to say, what we know from the auto industry is, It took the auto industry being at death's door before they finally admitted that Toyota had figured out something about the production line that GM and Ford didn't know. I think it would be a shame for American companies if they have to be at death's door before they say, this online-only sales, social media, soliciting feedback from users, this way that Xiaomi has figured out to build on the internet as a kind of new platform. I think it would be a shame if American companies really have to be brought to the brink of collapse before they're willing to change the way the auto industry
is. I don't think the U.S. tech industry is so back on its heels. But, I mean, here's an innovative way of looking at things. They design and build smartphones, but here's the president again, Ben Lin. This was in Laguna Beach with the Journal. They don't even want to see themselves as a smartphone builder. That's just a tool to be, here he is saying, an internet company, talking with George Fowler.
We'll rather be called as an internet company.
Internet company.
Yes. As some of you are already very familiar with our motto, we sell all these products online directly to consumers via me.com, you know, our own website. And we are also really focusing on building out smartphones to begin with as the center of all these devices that we launch. Mm-hmm. And users are able to enjoy a lot of services that we are providing on the phone, you know, on these other devices, you know, TV and other things.
So they make the phones, but they're more than that. They are the internet. Alan in Chesapeake, Virginia. You're on the air. Thank you for calling, Alan.
Hey, Tom. Getting back to something you said earlier about why is this working in China with such an authoritarian and controlling government,
mm-hmm.
I see two things. One, it helps the Chinese government because people will post stuff on Facebook that they won't tell their friends. And the social media helps with cyber espionage, et cetera, et cetera. Tom, here in America, the Amish are a very controlled group, yet we can buy stuff from them. And what Clay is saying about make the user happy and they will pay you,
mm-hmm.
is absolutely right. I don't think that, like, the automobile industry or U.S. manufacturing, it'll have to be at Death Door, because technology allows newbies, startups, people who never heard what a 45 record was or that made in Japan was cheap.
And in this country, too, you're saying, Alan.
Everyone can do it, and that's what's opened up the business and the internet for everyone, Americans, Indonesians, Africanos.
Yep.
We just have to see the global village. And Clay, I'd like to hear your comments.
So I think the democratization of innovation is absolutely something we're seeing as part of this story. I mean, certainly there are innovative companies now in you know, well outside of the sort of North American continent that we're used to. And we're seeing people optimize for local conditions. So the question of Xiaomi's next markets, we were talking about this earlier, they are looking at moving into African markets. They're looking at moving into South American markets because the conditions there are different enough that you could sell a phone. But one of the interesting things we know is that whenever the smartphones arrive in new markets, there is then this sort of follow-on market of app development and app innovation, which tends to be much more local than the hardware. So I think that the smartphone is really the platform, even more than the PC and the laptop, that's kicking off a lot of this local optimization, local innovation in different countries, different language groups, different continents. And that effect is, you know, separate from Xiaomi. That's just the rise of open platforms that people can write apps for, knowing that there's going to be a billion users of whatever platform you pick.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Clay Shirky. His new book is Little Rice, Smartphones, Xiaomi, and the Chinese Dream. Xiaomi means little rice, the name of a smartphone designer manufacturer in China that has gone very, very big in a very short time. Second highest valuation startup in the world right now after only Uber. You can join us. What do you see? Is this China moving beyond being the world's factory to being its own designer, its own creator? Clay, take us right to this issue of how far China can go in being an info age leader when its government is absolutely focused, you write in some considerable detail, on complete control of the info sphere.
Well, this is the big issue. And in the book, I can only speculate about this because this is essentially the next phase. China is moving from being a manufacturing economy to being more design-centric, but also more services-centric. Earlier you said, oh, the American tech industry is not on its, it's not back on its heels. But it absolutely is back on its heels on the hardware side. And if the Internet of Things stuff takes off, then China, then whoever gets the services economy right mm-hmm. is going to dominate the next phase of tech. So ordinary services make my, you know, make my air conditioner go up or down, whatever. That stuff is fine. But the minute a service starts to allow people to exchange opinions or coordinate actions, the Chinese government gets very nervous.
Repeat that again. The minute it does what? That's interesting. Does what?
The minute any service allows people to share opinions or coordinate actions, that's what makes the government nervous.
But that's what we think of as Facebook or Twitter, or that's what we think of as the Internet.
And when you look at social media in China, what you see is the services that allow for the formation of large groups or rapidly spreading opinion or the coordination of anyone in real space are very tightly curtailed relative to what we're used to in the U.S. So now you have Xiaomi, which has said, we make hardware, but we are a services company. They want to be compared to Amazon more than Apple. The huge question is, can you be good at service design in the rest of the world if you also have to do what Beijing wants to operate in China? And so far, because what people are mostly reacting to is, hey, this is a really nice phone and it's really cheap, they've got the hardware sales. But as they move to services, they already have to make two different versions of their operating system, one of them with Google Apps installed, one of them with Google Apps not installed, to sell on different sides of what's called the Great Firewall, the Chinese internet blockade.
So one designed for more social control, one designed for less.
Exactly right. And the only country in the world where we are experts at doing what Beijing wants is a selling point is China. And so a lot of the energy that goes into getting that right doesn't translate well outside the firewall. This is a really big problem for the big, you know, Chinese social media companies like WeChat and RenRen and QQ. They are basically not portable in their current structure because they don't offer the services people want, which is considerably more freedom than the Chinese government is willing to allow.
Unless the China is able to export its kind of political view along with its technology. I mean, if it's embedded in there that you don't have the same social interaction or freedom, does that take Chinese politics abroad too?
The Chinese would very much love to export their politics. They would very much love to say, we want to follow at least Chinese citizens around the world, censoring them wherever they are. The best U.S. parallel I know of is the Dred Scott decision from the Supreme Court in the 1800s, which said if you take a slave out of the slave state, they're still a slave even if they go to a free state. Mm. The Chinese would very much love to extend their cloud of censorship. They did it with LinkedIn for a while, where LinkedIn was censoring posts from people they believed were in China, even if those people were American citizens, and in one famous case, even if the American citizen had actually gone back to the U.S. So this is going to be one of the big battles coming up. If it all hinges on kind of commodity services like buy and sell things, make my start my coffee when I wake up in the morning before I get up. If that's what the Internet of Things turns into, then many Chinese companies are well positioned to take advantage of it. But if people expect integration with Facebook and Twitter and Google and the services that have made their not just made their money, but essentially become beloved by their users based on letting those users do whatever they would like, then all of a sudden the Chinese companies have a much harder time exporting their services, and it may start to only work in countries that actually want to import the censorship regime as well, like Turkey or Iran.
Tom in Stuart, Florida, you're on with Clay Shirky in Shanghai. Thanks for calling, Tom.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm a bit troubled by the premise that you've raised a couple of times that China lives in an oppressive censorship environment. It does. But don't we as well? And are we in any position, after seeing the Snowden revelations, to be acting as if this sort of censorship exists only there, and therefore the question of whether it can be technologically innovative under this regime is a question that only applies to the Chinese?
Well, it's a fair question in this time, Tom. I mean, I'm conveying what Clay's writing here in some detail about just how tightly sewn the Chinese control can be. I guess it's a matter of degree. I mean, Clay, you say Beijing wants their citizens to have economic freedom, a pretty good degree of personal freedom, and a low degree of political freedom. They've got five no's and six no's and things you can't do. Tom says, what about us? We're going to talk about this in a second, the latest on the cybersecurity front here. Right. There's, of course, surveillance in the U.S., but do a little comparative analysis in the time we have, just a couple of minutes.
So every government faces this trade-off between three options: propaganda, censorship, and surveillance. In the United States, we now know from the Snowden revelations that surveillance was what the U.S. doubled down on. We probably have the most advanced surveillance of our own citizens in the U.S. thanks to the NSA. China has made a different choice. China has really doubled down on both propaganda and censorship. They doubtless have surveillance as well. But the difference between China and the U.S. is both the affirmative injection of government opinions into the internet, into all sorts of online spaces, and also absolutely pervasive censorship of certain topics and certain forums.
You can't even use puns. You can't use puns, you tell us, Clay.
Right.
Because they could have a political double entendre meeting, they won't take it.
There are classes of puns they have banned. At one point, there was a class of time travel that they said you couldn't include in stories anymore. It is
why time travel?
So time travel allows you to imagine a China that's not controlled by the Communist Party. It's simply too much historical revisionism to imagine, in particular, much time travel in China's in the past to sort of other glorious ages, and that just became politically threatening. So while the U.S. is the U.S.'s reliance on surveillance, you know, the Snowden revelations have been horrific. What the U.S. is doing is different in terms of what people are allowed to say than in China. China is far more censorious than anything that happens in the U.S.
Bottom line, we've poked at it, but can they take the lead position in high tech with that urge to control and maintain a single authority?
They can easily take the lead in some kinds of high tech. They clearly can't take the lead in others. They will never have a network that's as popular as Facebook because it doesn't deliver the things that Facebook delivers. It's the stuff in the middle, which is exactly where Xiaomi is, that's the important question.
The global mid-market, huge strides there, and maybe beyond. Clay Shirky's new book is Little Rice, Smartphones, Xiaomi, and the Chinese Dream. He's at NYU Shanghai and joined us from Shanghai today. Clay Shirky, it's always great talking with you. Thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us.
And you, Tom, thanks so much for having me.
Clay Shirky, in a moment, we look at the controversial act that passed the U.S. Senate yesterday, letting the U.S. government and companies share cyber threat information. This is On Point. Yesterday, the Senate passed the Cyber Information Sharing Act, or CISA, 74-21, to strengthen the country's cybersecurity by allowing the government and companies to share information on cybersecurity threats. Proponents say it will do that, improve security. Detractors, critics say it could allow the government to cross more deeply into surveillance. Joining me now from Washington is Vox senior correspondent Timothy Lee, who's been covering this story. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What's the genesis of this bill? The House has passed it. The Senate has now passed it. What's the genesis?
Well, so there's been a lot of discussion about how we need to do more to secure the internet. And one thing that a lot of companies are concerned about is that they want to be able to share information with each other and with the government about ongoing attacks, about malware that's spreading around the internet and so forth.
And we've seen a lot. It's Sony and Anthem and the government's own Office of Personal Information, a huge hack there.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the concerns that the companies have is that if they do this too aggressively, they could inadvertently disclose information about their customers that might be protected by various privacy laws, and that these privacy laws are slowing down this information sharing and making it more difficult to respond to attacks.
So you've got Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat out of California, Senator Richard Burr, a Republican out of North Carolina, co-sponsoring this in the Senate. What does this build on? What does it do? What does it permit that wasn't permitted before, if it's signed by the president?
So it gives companies fairly broad immunity from privacy laws and other laws that would restrict the sharing of information if they are if they're sharing what the law defines as cybersecurity information with the Department of Homeland Security, which is a government agency that's involved in these kinds of activities.
So like what? This is described by critics as a sort of open door into private companies' cyber realms, which has all kinds of information about individual American citizens.
Well, so this is, I think, one of the reasons the law is controversial. It's pretty broad, and it's not very specific about what type of information. It needs to be information that's related to dealing with a cyber threat. And so I think the kind of example that the supporters have in mind is something like, say, somebody's trying to hack into a Bank of America's website. Bank of America might let the DHS know that, and then they might talk to other banks and say, hey, you should watch out for this guy or whatever. But the law is not narrowly targeted in that way. It doesn't just specify a few specific types of threat information that could be shared. It basically says anything that's relevant for fighting these kinds of attacks can be shared. And the concern then is that this could be interpreted very broadly. If you think back to how the NSA interpreted laws regarding phone records, the NSA basically said that all phone records are relevant for fighting terrorism. You can imagine the government taking a similar tack and saying to banks or to Google or whoever that trying to get them to share very broadly on the theory that like lots and lots of information is relevant to cybersecurity.
I mean, not least, there's language in here that says, as I'm reading it here, this is the new CISA law passed yesterday by the Senate. Spells out that any broadly defined cybersecurity threat information can be shared, quote, notwithstanding any other provision of law. Does this trump every other privacy protection out there with that language, Timothy?
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I think civil liberties groups have been saying, is that rather than having this very broad language that's saying we're just going to trump everything, a different approach they could have taken is to itemize, say, this privacy law and this privacy law are modified in these specific ways. And so one of the things people are worried about is the unintended consequence, where maybe we'll find out 10 or 20 years in the future that actually the government interpreted this in a way that preempted laws that Congress wasn't thinking about at all when they passed this law.
Part of the reassurance here as well, this is voluntary participation by American corporations. They don't have to. It's voluntary. So it's okay. But does that stand up?
Well, I think that certainly a voluntary piece of legislation is going to be less of a concern to privacy groups than if they're mandating it. I think what critics of the bill are worried about is that the government has lots of levers they can use to strongly encourage companies to participate in surveillance. They can. Many of these companies have contracts with the government. There's various other ways they can threaten and cajole these companies. And so the concern is that once it's legal to share the information, companies will come under a lot of pressure to participate in programs that the government comes up with. And so privacy groups at least would rather maintain the stricter limits on what information companies can share.
I mean, not least because if companies don't participate in data sharing and government the collection of their data, then they can't count on the government helping them if they've got a cybersecurity problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, we would hope the government wouldn't be too vindictive about it. But yeah, that's another way the government could leverage, say, either you have to participate in this program and give us maybe a lot of information, or we're going to not let you participate and then you don't get any information. And so companies, even that might be a little bit uncomfortable with the amount of information being shared, might still feel a lot of pressure to participate.
Who's been pushing for this? Who's been pushing against, Tim? I mean, Facebook has not been on board with this, as I'm reading here.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things. The people that I've talked to have been sort of inside this debate say that most of the pressure is coming from the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and from the intelligence community, the NSA and CIA and groups like that. There has also been the Chamber of Commerce is very supportive of this because, most companies, if you offer them protection against getting sued, most companies will say yes to that. But interestingly, it actually hasn't been that popular among technology companies. There are two big tech industry trade groups that have actually come out against the legislation because they felt that the privacy protections were not sufficient. And then big privacy groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation have also been strongly opposed.
They say here, I'm reading, the incentive and framework it creates is for companies to quickly and massively collect user information and ship it to the government. They're a legislative analyst for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Is the White House on board with this? This has now passed House and Senate. Does it look likely that the White House will sign off?
Yes, I believe the White House is supportive of this version of the legislation, so it likely will get signed. It's interesting. The White House has kind of gone back and forth on it. There's been several versions of this legislation over the last few years. And a previous version, a couple years ago, the White House actually threatened a veto because they thought the privacy protections were not sufficient. And I guess this version of the bill was a little bit better from their point of view, so they're likely to sign it.
Maybe better, or maybe Americans are just going to live with it. Kind of amazing what a huge umbrella this piece of legislation is. CISA is the acronym, Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, passing the Senate yesterday, 74-21, already through the House, on its way now to the White House. Civil liberties and privacy advocates saying, watch out, there is too much in here for this to be the law of the land. But that's the track it's on. Timothy Lee is senior editor at Vox.com. Tim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Fatima Tanis and Dave Tarantino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.